from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, Harvard Public Policy professor and author Robert Putnam, who gave us the much-praised Bowling Alone, and who has been described as a preeminent academic expert on American life, will join us for a wide-ranging discussion. We'll talk with him about religion in today's United States. He recently published a book with David Campbell called American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. It's an extensive study of conduct and attitudes related to religion and religious affiliation. Robert Putnam in studio, the hour ahead, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Harvard political scientist Robert D. Putnam joins us for this Forum hour to discuss his new book, co-authored with Notre Dame political scientist David E. Campbell, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. The Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard, Robert Putnam is author or co-author of many books, including the best-selling Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and Better Together, Restoring the American Community, both which we discussed with him on Forum. He's also worked with world leaders and grassroots activists around the world and was called, quote, the most influential academic in the world today by the London Sunday Times. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, The Economist, USA Today, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and he served as dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He's a recipient of the Skyette Prize, a prestigious international award for scholarly achievement in political science. And he joins us in studio for this Forum hour. And Bob, good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Boy, the most influential academic in the world today, for a guy who's pretty humble, that's a pretty heavy crown to wear, isn't it?
I always flinch when people mention that.
Well, but it's certainly a testament to your work. And this is an extraordinary study, the new book that you've put out. And I want to get right into it. I mean, just the amount of canvassing and the amount of work that went into it is sort of breathtaking. We were just talking a little bit off the air about the most rapid growing group of religious affiliates, which are people who are not affiliated.
I mean,
the non-believers, many of them believe in God, of course, but non-religious affiliated went from, 7% back in 1990 to 17% in the most recent?
Yeah. It's a big jump. It's a very significant fact. This rise of people who say they're unaffiliated with any religion, when you ask them what religion they are, historically that figure was, as you say, 5 to 7%. It's now 17%. Among young people, that is, among people under 30, that figure is now almost 30%. So this is unlike the development of secularization in Western Europe, which came on very slowly and goes, you know, steadily at a percentage point or two every decade. This happened very suddenly. It happened, tried to show in the book, it was largely a result of a reaction by a young generation of people who, when they were coming of age in the 70s and 80s, there was a tight connection between religion and politics, and they effectively said, well, look, if religion is just about being a conservative Republican and being intolerant and being homophobic, that's not me. I'm out of here.
And that's why you hear so many young people say to this day, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, or I don't belong to any religious affiliation, but I'm spiritual.
Well, as you say, these people, it's a little misleading to call them unbelievers, because when you ask them about God or other aspects of religious behavior, they're actually not all that different from their predecessors. More than half of them say they believe in God or say they're sure that there is a God. Many of them pray regularly. So they're not, in their behavior, completely detached from religion, but they are very detached from organized religion. As they see it, organized religion is about being conservative and being intolerant, and that's not them.
Well, I'm sure that 9/11 and pedophile priests, I mean, a lot of things contributed to this disaffiliation. And plus, America's become, as you point out in your book, a kind of a one-stop shopping. You know, it's like Safeway as far as religions. People switching religions all the time, taking something from the East, taking something from the West. It's very eclectic.
Yeah, religion is no longer really inherited, we used to think of it as an inherited trait, you know, like race or ethnicity or something. It's now much more a chosen characteristic that actually, to some extent, has contributed to the polarization of American life in terms of religion and politics, because people have moved religiously to either the very religious end of the spectrum or the very secular end of the spectrum, depending on their politics. We were shocked to discover that people, when their politics and religion are inconsistent, are more likely to adjust their religion to fit their politics rather than the other way around. So that's this, as you say, mixing and matching of religions on the one hand means we become more polarized. On the other hand, if you think about it in the sort of aggregate terms, it's part of the reason why we get along, because almost all of us have good friends in some other religion. When we all inherited our religion and lived in little segregated enclaves, you didn't know anybody who wasn't of your own faith. But now, when we ask people, tell us about your closest friends, your go-to friends, the people you'd really want to help you if you had cancer or your marriage was falling apart or whatever, half of the average American's most intimate friends are in some other religion. And as you say, more than a third of all Americans have changed religions from the one they grew up in. And as a result, these personal networks across religious lines have actually, during the same period of polarization, made us more tolerant of other religions, because we all love someone who's in some religion other than our own.
It's also certainly a testament to all the interfaith marriages that have occurred, and maybe the First Amendment, that the United States is unlike so many other countries where there, you know, you learn some fascinating things here. You learn that Americans on the average are more religious than Iranians.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet there's so much more religious tolerance, and one assumes that it has to do with perhaps the country being based on religious freedom for the Puritans, although they did, you know, kill witches and pagans and all that. I mean, in fact, that's kind of the division in some ways, isn't it? It unites and it divides
us. Yeah,
that's
right. There's
still a lot of that bigotry and a lot of the internecine stuff going on.
Yeah, that's true. As you say, the subtitle of the book, American Grace, is How Religion Divides and Unites Us. And initially, I wouldn't say the Puritans were all that tolerant of other folks. They if they could have imposed their own religion, they would have done it. But
precisely my point when I said they were, you know, going after the heretics, the pagans, the Indians, the,
right,
the witches.
That's right, exactly. So the First Amendment is an important part of the story here. But after all, we've had periods of great religious prejudice in America. I mean, you know, less than 100 years ago, well, about 100 years ago, there were anti-Catholic riots in America. People were killed over that, what was then Protestant-Catholic split. And of course, there's been a lot of anti-Semitism historically directed against Jews.
And now Jews are popular.
Yeah, that's one of the most startling things about the findings here is that we asked everybody how they felt about all the other religions in America, and the two most popular groups in America, judged by people who are not in that group, are Jews and Catholics. And that shows what a dramatic change we've been through over this period. Partly it is intermarriage. As you say, there's been a sharp, steady increase in marriage across faith lines. By now, more than half of all marriages today cross faith lines. Chelsea Clinton's marriage to this Jewish guy is now totally normal. When I was growing up, 30, 40, 50 years ago, intermarriages like that were anything but common.
Actually, when we were growing up, it was even people, Italian Catholics and Irish Catholics, or conservative Jews and Reformed Jews. I mean, those are considered like interfaith.
Right. They didn't go to my shul.
And then there's still some asperity and lack of warmth, I think, is the way you phrase it, toward, well, Muslims and unfortunate as a result of 9/11 and all of that, or the kind of bad propaganda that is fomented all the time. About xenophobia, you know, whatever you want to attribute it to, but surprise and Mormons, and that didn't surprise me as much, given the fact that Mitt Romney had a lot of evangelicals who were very unhappy with him. But Buddhists,
yeah,
what is it about Buddhists that drives?
Well, the Buddhists, we as you say, we compared the standing of the popularity, so to speak, of various religions, and Mormons, and as you say, Muslims are low. And your first thought might be, well, just as you said, the rating of Muslims must be somehow tied to terrorism and so on. We don't think, actually, that that's a much very important part of it, because Buddhists are almost as low ranked by the average American across the country as Muslims. And so far as I know, there's not been any great epidemic of Buddhist terrorism, unless behind Al-Qaeda, you know, there's some some big Buddha that's causing it all. Of course, it isn't that. It's that all three of those religions, Buddhism, Islam, and Mormonism, are characterized by lacking the interpersonal ties, for other Americans, I mean, that are true nowadays of Catholics and Protestants and Jews and evangelicals and so on. So we say in the book...
Not as much exposure.
Exactly right. We say in the book that the reason why America has this greater tolerance is because almost everybody in America has an Aunt Susan who is some religion other than you. Aunt Susan is Catholic and you're Baptist, or Aunt Susan is Baptist and you're Jewish, or Aunt Susan is Jewish and you're Methodist or whatever. And you know your faith says, poor Aunt Susan, she's not going to make it to heaven. She doesn't pray at the right altar. But, I mean, come on. You know Aunt Susan. If anyone's going to heaven, Aunt Susan is surely going to go to heaven. And all of us, therefore, all of us are caught in this sort of dilemma between what our faith formally says on paper, this person's, this faith of people, you know, they're sadly not going to go to heaven, and Aunt Susan. And Aunt Susan almost always wins. And the problem, if I can put quotation marks around problem, the problem with Muslims and Mormons and Buddhists is not that many Americans have a Buddhist Aunt Susan or a Mormon Aunt Susan.
It's almost analogous to before gays came out of the closet.
Exactly right.
You got Uncle Bob or, you know, Cousin Jim who happens to be gay, and so there's much more tolerance. But I'm wondering why Aunt Susan wins. I mean, it says something maybe about lack of doctrinaire beliefs. Remember, the Southern Baptist leadership group came out and said, you know, non-Baptists are going to go to hell. They can't go to heaven. They're talking about Jews and other Christians, of course. And yet, your study shows that most Christians actually believe that those who are not of the same faith are not going to be necessarily kept from going to heaven.
Well, most, there are surveys about this. Most religious leaders in Christian, especially evangelical flavor of religion, not most, all of them say Christians are not going to heaven. But if you talk to people in the pews, as we did a very large nationally representative survey, 3,000 people, talked to the people twice all across the country, good mirror of America. So if you talk to the people in the pews, more than half of all evangelicals say you don't have to be Christian to be saved. I was speaking to the annual theological meeting of the Missouri Synod Lutherans a year or so ago, reported these findings. They loved the rest of the book, but this part they just hated because they said it's just not true. And they said, well, fortunately, Missouri Synod Lutherans all know the deal is that if you're not Christian, you don't go to heaven. And I had with me my laptop and had the data set on the right on the podium. And so I actually was able to say in real time, actually, you know, most Missouri Synod Lutherans don't believe you have to be Christian to go to heaven. Deep gloom spread across the room.
As Garrison Keillor said, Lutheran gloom is a specific kind of gloom. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Robert Putnam, who along with David Campbell has put out a book called American Grace, How Religion Divides Us and Unites Us. Something about grace, in fact, today we're talking in the next hour with Michelle Norris, who's written a book with grace in the title as well. And we won't necessarily get into the theology of grace except to say with you that you discovered that Half of Americans do say grace before they actually put food in their mouths, and it's a strong predictor of social and political beliefs and the things that people do in life.
Yeah, we were surprised at that finding too. Most things in the world, most things in life, are distributed according to a normal curve. That is, there are some people do it a lot and some people do it a little, but most people are kind of middling of the road. Grace is quite unlike that. Half of all Americans say grace every day. And half of all Americans never say grace. And in turn, that predicts a whole lot of other things about them, who they vote for and their attitudes towards homosexuality and so on. And of course, there are exceptions, but it's a nice symbol of how America has, in some respects, become divided into two nations.
Well, let's talk about those two nations, because there is still that division, and that division is still pretty dramatic in many ways, especially when it comes to like social attitudes and attitudes towards same-sex marriage and homosexuality and so forth. I mean, all these things are changing, but there seems to be a religious divide that's very much tied to the political divide.
Yeah, more so than ever before, Michael. It used to be in the even as late as the 1960s and 1970s that there were plenty of liberals or progressives or Democrats in the pews on Sunday morning, and plenty of unchurched conservatives. But those two categories are now rapidly vanishing as people adjust their religion to fit their politics. So now there are very few progressives in the pews on Sunday morning. I don't mean none. No doubt some of your listeners are liberal and churchgoers, but that's a very small fraction of the U.S. population, and getting smaller all the time as people migrate religiously to a church or to a faith or to no faith at all that's more consistent with our political beliefs. I'm not sure that'll continue forever. Historically, it's important to remember, historically, most of the major progressive movements in American history have drawn importantly on religious roots and religious organizations.
Beginning the civil rights movement, the abolition movement before that, and so many social liberation movements.
Exactly right.
What's fascinating is even today, when many people associate Falwell and all these characters as being somehow tied to the interconnectedness between religion and politics, it's the more liberal congregations that are the more political congregations.
It's certainly the more explicitly political. That's right, exactly. We find, and of course other scholars, we're trying to write a comprehensive book here, but we're building also on the work of many other scholars. And it's a common finding that there's more overt politicking in liberal congregations than in conservative ones. Of course, there is a lot of political influence in conservative churches, but it's not coming from the pulpit, contrary to what most secularists think. It's not coming from the pulpit. It's coming from in the pews as people in those churches reinforce one another's conservative inclinations.
Our guest is Robert Putnam, and his new book, co-authored with David E. Campbell, is called American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. There really is a difference, I mean, a distinct difference, as you point out in your book, with the millennial generation and how they regard religion, not only how they regard religion, but many of the kinds of things that have been traditionally associated with religion. They become, in effect, more secularized.
Yes, that's absolutely right. As we said at the beginning of the discussion, we call those people the nuns, not Catholic sisters, but the N-O-N-E-S, because they don't have any. They say that they don't have any religious affiliation, but it's a recent phenomenon. It's closely tied to their rejection of right wing politics, which they see as intimately connected with religion. Indeed, the best predictor of which of the young people will end up in the category of "I have no religion" is their attitude on homosexuality, actually. So beginning in the 1990s, young people began to become much more tolerant of homosexuality and gay marriage and all that goes with it.
And choice with abortion, too?
No, abortion is a different story, actually. What happens in about 1990 is there begins to be a sharp movement among young people to become more tolerant of homosexuality. It's partly, as you said, you know, Uncle Bob, who comes out of the closet and discovering, well, Uncle Bob is gay, maybe that's okay. It's partly, you know, what's happening in the media and so on. But for whatever reason, there's a sharp movement in the liberal direction among young people in the 1990s and into this century on homosexuality at just the moment that the most visible religious leaders are having all these referenda, anti-gay marriage referenda and so on around the country. So the would-be followers zigged in one direction, and the would-be leaders zagged in the other direction. And a lot of the young people at that point said, "Well, you know, I'm out of here," and they voted with their feet. Many of those people are actually religious in their orientations. We can see this. They pray. They say they believe in God, and so on. So, in a way, that's an untapped pool of, from a religious point of view, souls waiting to be saved. And I wouldn't be surprised if religious entrepreneurs over the next decade or so try to reach that pool of people. But for now, they're not in touch with organized religion.
You also hear from a lot of these younger people, everything happens for a reason. Or, like I said, I'm a spiritual seeker and I'm spiritual, or the universe is looking out for me, or there's karma. I mean, it's a kind of belief, but it's often away from what we would think of as a traditional affiliated religious way.
Oh, it's not at all a traditional affiliated religious connection. But those beliefs are actually a little – many of their beliefs are not all that easy to distinguish from traditional religious beliefs. For example, almost exactly half of these young people say that they are absolutely sure that there is a God. So these are very far from being, you know, Christopher Hitchens atheists.
There are many more of those than there have ever been.
There are more, but the growth in actual real atheism, meaning you do not believe in God, is much smaller than you might think.
In all of America.
Yeah, in all of America, that's true.
Very small. But
sure.
You've got Hitchens and Dawkins, Sam Harris, who was just on last week,
sure,
for example. They've had a lot of influence, especially on more educated young people, don't you think?
I don't want to deny the importance of another author's work, but if you look at the data show that the really sharp movement is in young people, is a real movement, young people who are unconnected with any organized religion, though they believe in God. And that change, you can see it in the charts and graphs in our book, is very distinctly associated with the movement of our organized religion in a rightward direction.
It's still faith is underlying,
yeah,
undergirding.
That's right.
What about bridging? I mean, you use that word.
Yeah. Well, as I say, the one of the things we were surprised by is that all of this moving around that people do, a third of us are now in a religion other than the one we were raised in, which means that a third of us at least are in a different religious tradition than our own parents or our own kids. And that doesn't count, movements among very closely related religions. I mean, if you count moving from a Methodist to Presbyterian, say, then it's more like 40%. That have changed. And as we talked about, high rates of intermarriage and high rates of connection in our most intimate friendships. And what that means, that those bridging personal ties mean that there's a kind of a discrepancy between the trend at the national public level, which has been bitter and polarized and so on. That's the culture wars story, and it's a real story, and you can see that the effects of that in our data. But also, at the same time, at the level of people's interpersonal relations, actually growing tolerance, including tolerance by religious people of non-religious people. I'm not talking about what's in the headlines. I'm talking about what people say when you talk to them in their living rooms.
You also do a lot of analysis of ethnic groups and religions.
Yeah.
For example, Asian Americans are less religious than any other racial group as a whole.
That's true. That's true, and it's even more surprising because in general, every immigrant group, when it moves to a new country, becomes more religious in the new country than it was in the old country, and then the people in the new country are. So when Swedes moved to the United States, they became more Swedish in Garrison Keillor's Minnesota than they had been back in Sweden. And when Jews migrated to the United States from the shtetl, they became more observantly Jewish on the Lower East Side than they had been back in the shtetl. And when Italians moved to the United States, they became more fervent regular Catholics than they had been in Italy. And that's true of Latinos now in America.
Which is why the Latinos are really the new Catholics, and the numbers are being replenished.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, the Catholic story is the story about the changes in the Catholic Church that we recount in this book is a really interesting story, because over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a collapse in Catholic affiliation among people who were raised as Catholics in this country, that is, Italian Americans and Irish Americans, Polish Americans, and so on. More than half of all almost two-thirds of all people who were raised as Catholics in this country are no longer practicing Catholics. On the other hand, just as they rushed out one door of the church, in through the other door rushed millions of new Latinos. And of the people under 30 who were in Mass yesterday, two-thirds of them were Spanish-speaking, not English-speaking. The Catholic Church is becoming very, very rapidly a Latino institution. Why Asians differ from that story of other immigrant groups, why they're less religious here, is a really interesting question, which I don't have any very good answer.
Well, I'm going to open up the phone lines because many of you may have other questions as well as answers, and you certainly should feel free to join us. Robert Putnam with us, professor of public policy at Harvard and co-author of American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. Do you think religion divides or unites? You may want to have, in a succinct way, your own story to contribute here, or you may just have questions. Feel free to join us. It's toll-free whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. That's our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour, Robert Putnam, discussing his new book, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, co-authored with David E. Campbell. The book includes, by the way, at least a dozen or so profiles of congregations across the country, and it attempts to illuminate the role of spirituality and faith in the everyday lives of Americans. Bob Putnam is professor of public policy at Harvard and author of many books, including Bowling Alone. He'll be at Stanford tonight at 7 o'clock. You can meet him and hear his lecture, the presidential lecture at Stanford, over in Hewlett Hall in room 200. In the meantime, you can talk with him, and let's go to your phone calls. Let me get a caller on from South San Francisco, Omid. It's the first caller. I'm sorry, I don't have a name here. Go ahead, please.
Gregory.
Gregory, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, in your studies, do you find that people are sort of moving in their own direction because society is becoming much more independent? And I know personally I've been seeking different places of religion for the past year, just trying to find something that really fits, and my individual quest to, you know, fulfill that inner, all those inner questions about, you know, God and all that other stuff. And I really find that I don't feel the need to satisfy others, you know, belief systems, and I really just try to find something that fits my own.
Yes, Gregory. That's thanks for the question, and it's a very good question. And you represent I don't know quite how old you are, but you represent the very modal that is most common orientation now of young people toward religion in America. They're not satisfied as people were a generation ago with sort of inheriting and going along with the religion of their forebears. Indeed, there's a label that fits your case exactly that is called seekers, and there are a lot of seekers in religious terms in America, probably more than ever before.
It's also what you call a God gap.
Yeah, the God gap.
Between the young and the older, yeah?
Well, the God gap we talk about actually is a slightly different one. It's the God gap is between Republicans and Democrats in terms of how religious they are.
It's also generational, though, isn't it?
There is a generational difference here, a big generational difference, that young people today, even young people always have been less committed to a particular religion. That's always true. And then as they settle down, they tend to find a religion and become more involved in their 30s and 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. That's always been true. But that people nowadays, young people nowadays, are starting from a much lower level of engagement with some particular religion than ever before in the past. That's what Gregory is describing, and I think he represents his cohort of young people.
And we thank you for the call, Gregory. The thing, I suppose, that people need to know from this study, among so many other things, is that religious people make generally better neighbors. Now, they may be less tolerant, but in terms of social capital, the things that you wrote about in Bowling Alone, well, they give more blood. All kinds of things that we think of as simply being good citizens and neighborly.
Yeah. We were a little surprised at the strength of that relationship. It is true that religious people give more in philanthropic terms, not just in the church, the church plate, putting money in the church plate on Sunday, but also give more to secular causes. They volunteer a lot more, and they volunteer not just to be a church usher, but to be to work on social problems. Two or three religious people are two or three times as likely to volunteer to work on secular problems as non-religious people are. They're more likely to be involved in community life, more likely to go to meetings, more likely to work on social community problems, more likely to be involved in local reform movements than secular people are, and as you say, more likely to give blood, more likely to let strangers cut in front of them in line and so
yeah,
on.
That's an interesting sidebar, but also less likely than secular to favor public policies which address things like poverty or inequality.
A little bit, that's right. They are a little bit less likely to focus on the underlying causes, as I would say it, the underlying causes of poverty. And that's an important qualification on this point that I've been making. Religious people would say that they favor private provision for the needy, and many of them, because they're more conservative now than nowadays than they used to be, less likely to favor government programs. That I wouldn't want to exaggerate that, though, because the differences on issues, for example, of social welfare policy are pretty small, measured in, you know, 5 percentage points one way or the other, whereas the differences in terms of volunteering or philanthropy or letting people cut in front of you in line or giving blood or so on amount to religious people being two or three times more likely to do good works or to be good citizens. It's important to add, though, that we were trying to figure out, well, why is that? Why are religious people more likely to be good neighbors and good citizens? And it turns out that theology has essentially nothing to do with it. How firmly you believe in God does not predict whether you...
Yeah,
whether
it's more social capital.
It is. The more friends you have in your religious congregation, the nicer a person you are. And for that matter, the happier person you are. We've also measured life satisfaction. That's another recently evolving study of among sociologists and economists. Some people are happier than others. Religious people are happier than other people. And it turns out that that's largely, again, because of their church friends. By that, I mean the people that they know through their religious communities. Those people who have a lot of church friends are happier and better citizens. Really firm believers, people who just are incredibly committed to their beliefs, but do that alone, pray alone, aren't really much better citizens. In a nutshell, you could say the book Bowling Alone that you referred to before says Americans individually and collectively would be better off if we went bowling in leagues than if we just bowl alone. And this new book says, ah, yes, but church bowling leagues, that's the ticket.
Let me go to more of our callers in Sacramento. Mark, you're on. Hi.
Hello. Hey, I'm curious about the trend of immigrants arriving in the nation and then either affiliating or not affiliating with the religious group. And I was curious to know if Asian groups on average are arriving and then participating in higher education or arriving with more affluence, and that might have something to do with whether or not religion is something that's important to them when they're here.
Mark, that's a really, really good question. And I have to begin by saying I do not know for sure why Asian people, immigrants from Asia, are unlike all the other immigrants that not only now but in the past. It's probably not, though, educational levels and affluence levels, because across the country as a whole, you'll be maybe surprised to discover this, education and income are slightly positively correlated with religion. That is, higher with church attendance or attendance at religious services. Educated people, college-educated people, are slightly more likely than less educated people to go to church on Sunday or to go to religious services. Most of the evangelical boom over the last 30 or 40 years, as Michael said, it ended about 20 years ago, but that evangelical boom mostly was concentrated among better educated Americans, not less well educated Americans. So I don't think education itself is likely to be the explanation for the puzzle, but you're right, it's a puzzle.
And there are some real class differences, too, that we should note here. I mean, in terms of church attendance and affiliation, aren't there?
Meaning that upper class people
are more likely to go to church.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. That's right.
Let me thank you for the call, Mark. We'll get more of your calls on. We'll go next to Harold. Morning. You're on Forum.
Hi. You've talked mostly about the sociological, political, social group aspects of religion as a sort of institutional. But I'm curious what your research, if you've done any research on this, what their conception of God, their religious intuitions are. I know there's many different conceptions of God, you know, from unmanifest to the man with the long beard in the sky. How does it break down among various groups, according to what you have found?
Well, we did ask a lot of questions about people's what you might call theology, that is, their beliefs about God. We did ask about how often, whether people thought of God as a loving, forgiving God or as a judgmental, angry God, whether they believe in heaven and hell and whether they believe in the second coming that's just around the corner and many, many other theological questions. I think the reason why we've not been talking about those factors, which are discussed in the book, as much here, is that by and large we don't find those theological differences to be to be crucial in explaining differences in people's behavior. As I said earlier, for example, in talking about our finding that religious people are better neighbors and better citizens, that's true without regard to what people's theological beliefs are, or without regard to how much they believe in God or whatever. It drives from their sociological connect, their friendships and other connections at church. In other words, we focus a little more on communities of faith rather than just faith itself. Of course, you're absolutely right. People do have beliefs about God and about the nature of the universe and so on, and we talk about those in the book to some extent, but I think we're focused more on the impact that religion has on our society and on politics. I'm not a theologian. I'm a political scientist and a social scientist. And in that context, the theology doesn't seem to matter as much as these social factors that I've described.
And yet you wonder how much theology really, like you say, it doesn't seem to play that much of a role in terms of civic involvement or citizenship as the communities themselves do, but you wonder how a lot of these people who are strongly religious and devout wrestle with what I call the theodicy questions, you know, questions about why evil exists and how can a compassionate, loving God allow for carnage and horror and all the rest of those kinds of things.
Those are important questions, and we don't address those questions in our book.
More in the realm of morality and I suppose in social science, but they are important questions. I agree. Here's David who writes, this is a fascinating program. Your guest listed which religions are popular and unpopular in America with some speculation as to why. As an atheist, I'd be interested in hearing where atheists appear on that scale. I've heard atheists are unpopular, and I wonder why. I know some people think you can't be moral without believing in God, but you don't see a rash of atheist bank robbers and all the politicians caught with their hand in the till claim great religious faith.
Well, that's an excellent question from David. And there are two ways of answering that. It certainly is true that the word atheist in America is very much a boo word. It's a negative word in the eyes of most Americans. I'm not trying to express my own view about it, but it's clear whenever anybody asks, how do you feel about atheists, using that word, they get really pretty low ratings. And that's no doubt a part of the explanation for why so few Americans actually identify themselves as, quote, atheists. We only found less than 0.1% of the people in our study describe themselves as atheists.
On the other hand, a lot of the Pew polls show that atheists and agnostics seem to be more moral in their behavior than many people have found.
There's debate about that question, actually. I don't know what counts as moral, but the evidence—
More ethical, I suppose, or more with ethics in mind.
I'm not sure that I would agree with that, but let me go back to the point that David asked, which is a really important one. If you ask people, and we did ask people, how do you feel about that? Ask everyone, how do you feel about people who are not religious? The ratings of not religious people are just about on a par with evangelicals. That is, everybody who is religious rates quote, people who are not religious at just about the same level as everybody who's not evangelical rates evangelicals. So they're a little less popular than Jews and Catholics and mainline Protestants, but substantially more popular than Mormons and Muslims and Buddhists. We ask a question. One question we did ask that is relevant to David's question, would you say that someone who has no religious faith could be a good American? Overwhelmingly, Americans say yes. Someone without religious faith could be a good American. That, when I say overwhelmingly, I mean 80-90% of Americans say that. On the other hand, if you ask, would you vote for an atheist, quote atheist, using the word atheist for president, a very high fraction of Americans say they would not. So I think partly we're dealing with a question of linguistics here, but it's certainly it's the word atheist has the same kind of charge in religious circles as the word communist has in political circles.
They were synonymous for a long time, weren't they? The God
well,
is but, communist. And
yeah, that's true. I wasn't. Yeah, but I mean, if you call someone a communist, that was a really heavy attack. And similarly, to call someone an atheist in American political culture is a pretty heavy attack.
Well, but there was always the village atheist, though. And I mean, remember, it's almost a kind of archetype in American life, even though now there are lots of atheists, or a lot more than there were when there was just the village atheist. By the way, here's a listener who says, I respect Bob Putnam's work, but when he talks about Buddhists and terrorism violence, it's clear that he's forgotten about the political violence wreaked by Buddhists in Sri Lanka against the Tamil, Hindu, Christian, Muslim population in the north. It's better not to romanticize any religious group. I don't know that those people who feel not so good about Buddhists are thinking about that particular element of history. But here's right. Alex who writes, just curious, my local Unitarian Universalism Church in San Mateo is definitely growing lately. This makes sense to me as it's a place for liberal faith, a kind of counterpoint to some of the trends you have referred to. Is the trend I see here locally being borne out throughout the country?
Well, that's a very good question because I think one thing that we argue in the book is that it would be a mistake to interpret the current trends, which are the sharp increase in people who are unaffiliated with religion, to treat those as going to, you know, and they're going to go on forever, because religious institutions will almost certainly react to that growth of the so-called nuns by developing new or re-emphasizing older forms of religion that might be just as attractive, but without the political edge that group of young people find so off-putting. And it could be Unitarian Universalists might be one of the winners in this. It doesn't, so far, the trends in membership and involvement nationwide don't bear out that this listener's experience, but it could be. And there could be other.
Getting, Judy tells me a number of emails saying that that the Universal Unitarian Church is growing and appealing to younger people, particularly.
I think that's potentially an important development. That is that the ideas that are involved in Unitarian Universalism could be the right mix for this group of young people. I agree with that. I don't actually know of any evidence that nationwide significant numbers of new people are joining Unitarian Universalist churches, but that could change in the future.
You know the old joke about the Ten Commandments in Unitarian Church?
I don't.
It's called the Ten Suggestions. Unitarians love that joke themselves. Here's Ed who writes, your discussion is confusing religion with denomination. Catholics and Baptists are Christians, for example. Nobody's saying otherwise, I don't think. I don't know why that...
Well, it may be that what I'm sorry, I missed the name of that reader or listener, I mean.
Ed.
It may be what Ed is thinking is that I've talked about how people of different faiths feel about each other and that there's a growing amount of tolerance. And it may be fair to say, well, they're all Christians. But, of course, people who are, quote, all Christians have been killing each other in the millions for the last, at least the last 500 years. Many, many Catholics and Protestants, both, quote, Christians killed each other in Northern Ireland in our lifetime. So I don't think that it's right historically to minimize differences by saying, oh, those are all just, they're all Christians.
Something else about Buddhism from one of our listeners named Vicky, who says Buddhism is atheistic and in Asian countries is proscriptive but not exclusive. No one is going to hell. When Asian people come here, they continue practicing their religion, but it is not necessary to organize it. In their home countries, Buddhist temples are community centers primarily, and they exist here also in large population centers as community centers, not religious centers. I don't know. When I think about this feeling about Buddhism, I'm reminded of I knew a woman who was teaching yoga, and she wanted to teach yoga to young kids as a meditative practice. And particularly in the Bible Belt and in places like Iowa and Nebraska, there was tremendous resistance. It was almost like, you know, she was trying to show them a Ouija board or something along those lines. In other words, it went against the grain of Christianity to bring in things like yoga. And Buddhism is perhaps seen in that way as being alien because it's talking about maybe ideas that are well, so far estranged from ordinary or traditional Abrahamic religions.
Well, yeah, I it's certainly true that it's to the average American strange, and the average American is suspicious of strange things. I'm not at all disagreeing with that, and I actually doubt that it has much to do with the content of Buddhism. I think that because the content of Islam and Buddhism and Mormonism could not be different, more different among the three of them, but they're all sort of in the same relatively lower status ranking, and I think that's probably not because of the content of the faith, but rather just because of the strangeness of it. And I frankly expect that as more people in America become Buddhist or Islamic or Mormon or whatever, that, and therefore we have more personal ties among or other Americans and them, that a lot of this antipathy will decline. That's been the entire history of American. It's easy for us now to take for granted the fact that Jews and Catholics are very popular, but it would not, a century ago, it would not at all have seemed natural that Americans would embrace Jews and non-Jewish Americans would embrace Jews and non-Catholic Americans would embrace Catholics. That's a product of our remarkable ability as a country to assimilate and to become comfortable with difference.
Well,
over the long run, not in the short run, but over the long run.
When we never would have believed we'd have a Catholic president, the Al Smith era, and then suddenly we have John F. Kennedy, and then I can remember, you know, the campaigning that went on that said, you know, the Pope will be ruling America, that sort of thing. And, you know, you have a black president now, and
right.
So America has progressed. What do you think, though, of since this is a big puzzle for you about why Asian Americans seem to be less religious, the ideas that are coming in from some of our emailers are that they don't seem that religious. In other words, community centers in different Buddhist practice as opposed to organizing religion here in the United States, that sort of thing.
Well, that could easily be a part of the explanation. We asked people, including the Buddhists in our sample, we asked them large numbers of questions about I'm conflating Buddhists and Asian immigrants, and that's not identical. Obviously, there are a lot of Asians who are Christian or Hindu or other sorts of religions. I think it's possible that what the callers are saying is that Buddhism might reflect a certain kind of religion that does not involve sanctuaries and does not involve regular church attendance, and that could very well be the explanation for why Asian Americans seem, not only in our work, but it's a common finding that Asian Americans seem less less religiously engaged than immigrants from other countries.
So speculation about Buddhism being more like atheism. Certain branches of Buddhism practice meditation and love and compassion teaching and all that, but don't necessarily – if you're looking for nirvana, you're not necessarily looking for God. You're looking for an extinction of consciousness as opposed to, let's say, again, the Abrahamic religions or, for that matter, Hinduism. But Buddhism goes back to a polytheism, too, that's very strong. And maybe Americans are somewhat distrustful. They like the one brand name God, you know, the monotheistic God.
Well, Islam is a one name brand name God. It's also an Abrahamic religion, as you say, and Americans don't feel very comfortable with with Muslims either. I think that's more likely to be because we just don't know that many yet.
We'll go to more of your calls, and we'll take a call from Gwyneth. Good morning.
Hi, I just was wondering how many Muslims you had interviewed in your book, and also where Muslims who are not happy with that doctrine go. It seems like they don't have much of a chance. I'm told that the Quran is the Quran, every word is what it is, and you can't dispute any of it. So what happens to someone who doesn't feel comfortable in that religion? Where do they go?
Well, let me distinguish two things, Gwyneth, for that really in response to that really interesting question. We have very few Muslims in our sample, our nationwide sample of 3,000 people, because there are very few Muslims in America. So we probably have, I've forgotten, something like 25 Muslims.
Gee, Bob, you could have gone to Dearborn.
Well, we could have, but it's actually not so easy to gather large numbers of Muslim interviews. And anyway, we don't have, and we don't ever make claims about what Muslims believe or how they behave, because we just don't have adequate evidence on that. On the other hand, we did ask all of our people how they felt about Muslims. So when I've been talking about Muslims, and for that matter, about Buddhists and other groups, I'm talking about how the rest of the country views them. I'm not really in a position to say much about how they view the rest of the country. As to how the rest of the country views these more exotic religions, I mean more exotic in the sense they've not historically been part of the United States, of the American population, we are able to say something about that, because we've talked to, you know, we've asked everybody basically in our sample about how they feel about Muslims and Mormons and how they feel about Methodists and how they feel about Jews and so on.
Here's a listener who says, sounds like your guest has a bias in favor of religious people. Where are the statistics about how religious people are more likely to be intolerant of others, less open-minded, more likely to try to enforce their beliefs on others, more likely to condescend to secular, etc.?
You know, it's really interesting, Michael, that whatever group I'm talking to, if I'm talking to a group of religious people, they think this book is biased against religion. And I get a lot of flack from people who say, you're just pointing out all the flaws in religion. And when I talk to a more secular group, they think, oh, you're biased in favor of religion. We're trying actually as best we can to call the facts as we see them. As you said earlier in introducing the book and introducing the discussion about the good neighborliness part, we do talk about the fact that religious people are less tolerant of difference. There's no question about it. I mean, the caller is absolutely right. Let me give a specific example. We ask all Americans, would you say that it would be all right for someone to give a speech defending Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden in America? So it's a test of how Americans feel about civil liberties of people who are defending something that is really pretty abhorrent to most Americans. There's two bits of information that are relevant. First of all, most Americans are surprisingly tolerant. About two-thirds of all Americans say that, yes, you should be allowed to give a speech attacking Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, religious people are a little less likely to say yes. I think the number is something like 55% of religious people, of church-attending people, say that you should be allowed to give this speech defending Osama bin Laden. So it's true, exactly as this listener says, that religious Americans are less tolerant of difference. And we talk about that at some length. But in the same spirit of calling the facts as we see them, we also report, and I think it's an interesting fact, that on many measures of good neighborliness and good citizenship, helping others and so on, religious people are, in fact, significantly more higher on that scale.
Bring another caller into this, and Mustafa joins us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm actually replying to the latest caller about, like, the image of Muslims in the United States. I consider myself Muslim, but I'm not a practicing Muslim. And what I noticed is that the impact of the media, like especially Fox News, bribing certain images that other people that are not well aware of who Muslims are. I mean, my personal experience is that no one knows what I am. And from my looks and everything else, like, no one considers me as a Muslim because they do not have a beard or a mustache or anything. But when people, like, realize that my background, I'm from Morocco, and when they started connected with me, they start connecting, and one of the things that they always say, you're different. But my answer is that I'm not. Like, there are, like, 300 million people, like, just like me. And maybe, like, you know, thousands or a million people that are on the radical end that are that started to represent me. I take offense to that in terms of, like, how much the conservative media is trying to use that platform as a sensationalist way. And I just want to, like, my question is that is the media has to blame in terms of the way Muslims are being seen today?
Excuse me, Mustafa, because we're coming to the end of the program here, and I think it's a good question. James Zogby and others have written not only about the media, but film and the way Muslims are portrayed and so forth. This must be at least a part of the equation, isn't it?
Well, I certainly – it's not part of my brief to defend Fox News, and I agree that there's been a politicization of this issue. But this was a context in which I referred to Buddhists, because there's been no, so far as I know, Fox News campaign denigrating Buddhists and
– or Mormons, for that matter.
Or Mormons, and yet they're ranked just about as – quote, low, as pejoratively in America, as Muslims are. So that's why I think that the other part of Mustafa's comment, that is that people, you know, are curious about him and don't know that much about Islam, is probably the more important reason for the low ranking of Muslims.
It's a fascinating book, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, by Robert Putnam and David Campbell. Thank you, Bob, for being with us. He'll be at Stanford tonight at 7 o'clock, presidential lecture, Hewlett 200. Thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.